Nuclear zombies. No, not a character from Night of the Living Dead. This zombie is a nuclear reactor that has been shut down for years that some brainiacs decided should be resurrected because, hey, AI. The Palisades nuclear reactor in Michigan has been shut down since 2022, and in the push to restart it, seemingly no consideration was given to the degradation of its components while sitting around idle for 2.5 years, and the extremely high risk its proposed restart poses for health, safety, security, and the environment. Nah, it's all about the money. So when a genuine expert, a nuclear engineer who has been deeply involved in the efforts to stop this ill-advised restart, tells us,
they are replacing and repairing hundreds of components that they let sit idle. They got close to $2 billion from the Department of Energy, and they got $300 million from the state of Michigan to turn this plant back on. But even then, they still have to have a subsidy because it's not cost competitive. So essentially the government, Michigan and the feds, have given them in excess of $2 billion to resurrect this plant. And when they get there, they're still going to have to soak the ratepayers for more than renewable energy would cost.
Well, when nuclear engineer, whistleblower, and green energy advocate Arne Gundersen breaks down exactly what's at stake with the restart of Palisades, including the safety of the water in Lake Michigan, you get another glimpse of how often and how variably we're being placed in that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, two interviews on two ongoing nuclear problems. We talk with Arne Gundersen about how the now obscenely well-funded push to restart the Palisades nuclear power reactor in southern Michigan, which has been up on the blocks for 2.5 years and, as you'll hear, wasn't in great shape before its shutdown. And our favorite marine biologist, radioactivity researcher, and consultant, Tim Deer Jones, rips into Japan's recent ridiculous claim that adding radioactive tritium to the Pacific Ocean does not increase the amount of tritium in the Pacific Ocean. We will also have nuclear news from around the world and more honest nuclear information than could be heard over the bagpipes at a recent presidential press conference in Scotland. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, July 29, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting off with multiple acknowledgments of next week's 80th anniversaries of the dropping of the atomic bombs by the United States on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In light of those anniversaries, and as renewed nuclear threats emerge in current conflicts, several U.S. Catholic bishops will travel to Japan on a pilgrimage of peace. They include cardinals from Chicago, Washington, Seattle, and Santa Fe, New Mexico, who will hold masses for the victims in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, accompanied by Japan's Archbishop Peter Michiaki Nakamura of Nagasaki, and Bishop Alexis Mitsuru Shirahama of Hiroshima. In related news, The World Council of Churches has called for unity in the church community in opposition to nuclear issues, which raises the question, are there churches in favor of nuclear? A statement from the WCC said, Pacific voices could not be marginalized and churches had duty to speak for those without a voice. Too often, Pacific voices are relegated to the margins of these power contests by centering Pacific Island priorities, community resilience, ecological stewardship, cultural integrity, rather than serving as chess pieces in geopolitical competition. The Ocean of Peace Declaration can reassert the agency of Pacific people. The chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, Jørgen Watne Fridnes, urged the Japanese government to take more steps to discourage the use of nuclear weapons amid rising global tensions. He said, Japan has special responsibility in a world where the nuclear taboo is under threat. We really believe that responsibility should be taken at a higher regard also from the Japanese authorities. His statements follow the committee's decision last year to award the Nobel Peace Prize to Nihon Hidyanko, the country's leading group of atomic bomb survivors. Japan is the only country to have suffered nuclear attacks, and it advocates for a world without the weapons, but at the same time, the country is protected by the U.S. nuclear umbrella deterrence and has not joined a UN treaty banning the weapons. Here in the U.S., lawmakers will consider draft legislation this week that would allow manufacturers of so-called advanced, that's one of the propaganda terms, but small modular nuclear reactors to store high-level radioactive waste at their Wyoming facilities. Radiant Industries proposes to build a nuclear small modular reactor manufacturing plant on the outskirts of the town of Bar Nunn. And as reassurance, put that in quotes, the company notes the location is, quote, actually over a mile away from any home. Like there's a barrier line and nuclear radiation that gets released won't go beyond it. Strangely enough, this meets the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission's distance requirements. Many local residents are objecting to Radiant's plan to house spent nuclear fuel waste on site, saying the location is too close to homes, schools, and businesses, with one of them saying, we want manufacturing. We would love for Radiant to come here and manufacture and put the waste somewhere else. Nuclear NIMBY. Isn't that the ongoing story? The Air Force started studying cancer rates in the nuclear missile community in 2023 due to pressure from ailing missile officers. Now, lawmakers may soon order an independent redo of an ongoing Air Force study on possible cancer risk in personnel manning its nuclear missiles. A provision in the House's draft defense policy bill would, if passed, require the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine to commission a study examining, quote, occupational health and safety conditions in Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missile facilities. The move comes after an independent researcher concluded there has been an increase in cases of a rare cancer at an Air Force missile base in Montana. It would be tasked with scrutinizing the methodology and design of the Air Force study on the possible risk. The United States has reportedly stationed nuclear weapons in the UK for the first time since 2008. According to a Bloomberg report citing defense analysts and open source data, the U.S. has likely flown the new B-61-12 thermonuclear bombs to the UK this month. According to the flight path, the aircraft flew directly from the U.S. to the U.K. without crossing any other country's airspace. The flight started from a nuclear weapons depot at Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and went to an airbase in the U.K. city of Lakenheath. In other U.K. nuclear news, the country has agreed to a deal worth more than £38 billion with private investors to back the Sizewell C nuclear power station project. A step towards what the government is calling a quote-unquote golden age of nuclear. The National Wealth Fund, which is the government's principal investor and policy bank, is making its first investment in nuclear energy and will provide the majority of the project's debt finance. Sizewell C, in Suffolk, southeast England, will cost 38 billion pounds, which is the same as 43 billion euros and 51 billion US dollars, is now almost double from what was projected when the project was first proposed. And there's no saying that it couldn't go even higher. This agreement marks the end of a 15-year struggle to secure investment for the nuclear plant since Sizewell C was first earmarked for new nuclear development in 2009. Just think how many windmills and solar panels could be put up all over the UK in that period of time and for this amount of money. Now here's the first of this week's two featured interviews. Last week, I read a story about a new study out of Japan that claimed that the release of tritium-contaminated radioactive water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean did not raise the amount of radioactive tritium in the Pacific Ocean. Besides the fact that they're counting on us not to do the math, I spotted a lot of tricky wording in the story and promised I would find out more. And that I have. I once again called upon Tim Deer Jones, marine biologist, marine radioactivity researcher and consultant, and a regular commentator on Nuclear Hot Seat. I sent him the story, and here's what he had to say about it. I spoke with Tim Deer Jones on July 25th, 2025. Tim Deer Jones, thanks for joining us on such short notice here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
My pleasure, Libby.
Tim, first of all, remind us, what is the source of the tritiated water, the tritium in the water that Japan is releasing into the Pacific Ocean?
Well, this is from the Fukushima disaster accident and its subsequent long-term effects. The site is a wreck. It's full of radioactive debris and waste, and it's also subject to being run through by runoff and groundwater from the high ground inland of it, which is running downhill towards the sea through the site. So there's that. Then they've got basements full of firemen's hose pipe water where they had the fires and they were spraying the fires and dropping water onto the site from helicopters in order to extinguish the flames, and that's highly radioactive. So it's an utter mess in there, and there are many, many sources of man-made radioactivity. All of that water, which I've just referenced, running through the site and collecting in the basements, etc., etc., that has been collected over quite a few period of years now, and they've got millions of gallons of it stored on shore in large containers, and they finally reached the stage a couple of years back where they didn't have any room for any more containers, and they've got to start getting rid of the damn stuff because it's becoming enormously expensive not only to store it but also to manage the stored containers, some of which are leaking and beginning to corrode and give up the ghost.
When tritium gets released into the marine environment, salt water, the Pacific Ocean, how does it behave? Does it float? Does it flow? Does it stick to things, sink down, combine with other elements? I mean, what does it do?
Tritium is a radioactive isotope of hydrogen. And water, as everybody knows, is H2O, so hydrogen and oxygen. So when tritium hits the water, the seawater, it mixes immediately and very effectively in just about 100% dissolves into the water body. So it's really hard to get out and extract and separate from water. And that's why it's being discharged in such high quantities, because it can't be taken out of the water body. And this is why all reactor sites discharge tritium all the time. And this is why the nuclear industry really wants to support the TEPCO's right to discharge tritium into the sea, because if they are ever told to stop, it sets a precedent and pretty much all the nuclear sites all over the world will have to stop discharging radioactive waste to sea, because the great bulk of the radioactivity they discharge to sea is tritium.
Do we know how far the tritium from this release, these releases, because they're multiple now, can and has traveled?
Analysis of that is proving a bit difficult because, again, it's quite expensive to actually analyze samples of seawater for tritium. But as far as we can see, it has got to the west coast of the States. It was discharged into something called the Kurushiya and the Oyoshiya currents, which run strongly down the Pacific coast of Japan in a southerly direction and empty into the greater Pacific at large. And so the stuff is probably beginning to be Pacific-wide now, just in terms of its presence in the water column. But of course, it's also being distributed by biological activity. So you've got a whole list of fish species which lay their eggs and have their juveniles being raised off the coast of Japan, and they spread out ocean-wide. Tuna's a fine example. There are several species of tuna which lay their eggs in the Oyoshio and Kuroshio currents, and those little ones grow up in that water body where it's more enriched with tritium because it's so close to the Fukushima site. And then as adults, they distribute themselves around the Pacific Ocean, and many of them come back to that particular area off the Fukushima coast, lay their eggs, have their babies raised as juveniles, and so the cycle continues. So I reckon that a decent large adult tuna, by the time it's 15 or 20 years old, you know, one of these things that's 6 foot long or longer, it's probably got a pretty high body burden of tritium. And the amount of analysis of these big fish that's been done is relatively low, but it does show that they're containing cesium and tritium from the Fukushima site. And elsewhere, when you do this kind of work, you find the older the fish is, the more it's got in its muscle and its organs.
So, looking at this new study, what is the model that was used to come up with these results?
The model is called COCO49 or 4.9. Not quite sure why it's called COCO. It's a model of generalized ocean circulation. It was devised in 2015, and its purpose is really is to model ocean circulations. So it's not really designed to model the behavior and fate and distant concentrations over time or distance of pollutants. So you can apply it to that work, but it's not its main purpose. So it's a bit like, say, using a bread knife to saw wood or a wood saw to saw bread. It has its applications, but it's not what its purpose is. When you look at the academic literature which has commented on COCO 4.9, you find quite a lot of it identifies a number of faults and flaws in it.
What are some of those faults or flaws as it relates to this situation?
It's multifaceted, but the biggest problem is just sheer lack of data. Now, as anybody who works with modeling knows, these hypothetical models are only as good as the actual empirical field data that you put into them. So the facts, if you haven't got enough facts, your model starts to get a bit vague and useless. Now, a lot of the critique that's been done on COCO 4.9 says that it lacks data. So if you haven't got enough data, then you've got a weak and feeble model which isn't going to give you 100%. And the less data you've got, the less close you are to 100%. Recently, in 2023, there was an article in Nature, the scientific magazine, which said that COCO 4.9 suffered from widespread global disparities between hypothetical modeling and empirical observed mid-depth ocean currents. What they said was only 3.8% of the Pacific mid-depth ocean has actually been subjected to data acquisition. So that's a tremendously small amount of a very large chunk of water. So that gives you an idea of how weak COCO 4.9 could be. Without going through a long list of quotes from various academic journals, take it from me. I mean, I've got a list here and it's got, well, maybe 10 or 15 separate sentences in it, which are negative comments about the weaknesses in COCO 4.9 for the job that it's designed to do, let alone for a job that it's not designed to do. So we've got a bit of a problem here. These guys are being over-optimistic in that paper with saying what they say, because the whole thing suffers from all these weaknesses of lack of data.
That's a very clear comment on the reliability or accuracy, put those two words in quotes, of using this model and the results they came up with. It was also applied to only a 25 kilometer, that's only a 15 and a half mile radius around Fukushima. What impact might this tritium release have in further reaches of the Pacific Ocean? And is there any way to study that?
Well, there is. You could just, spend the money, hire the boats and hire the staff and hire the equipment and get out there and do it. But as, I found over 40 years of working around the nuclear industry, they don't really like to spend money because, as you'll know, it's pretty much a loss maker anyway in terms of producing energy, and they don't want to spend any more money than they necessarily have to. And this is one of the reasons why the IAEA supported TEPCO doing what they've done, because they know damn well that if you force TEPCO to spend the money to do the necessary work, it'll cost a small fortune and the bank will be further broken than it already is. So what you could do, you could launch, have boats out there, you could have floats. I did floats in the UK, and dropping floats off the end of the pipeline very clearly showed us where radioactivity was travelling to over a period of about a year, this work we did. And wherever those floats came ashore, we found that the radioactivity on the beaches was rather high, and that we could locate it and identify it by its fingerprint and say, this comes from such and such a site. So they could do that, but they don't want to do that because it's going to cost money and it might bring them results which would cause greater amount of public alarm and concern, and they don't want public alarm and concern. Okay, so you could do that, but I mean, for me, the end destination of all this work would really be environmental and public health. So you could be looking for places where you would get exposures to people and see how those people are doing. And in this case, we're talking about tritium, so you could look for their tritium levels and the tritium in their seafood, the tritium in their coastal atmosphere, because we know that radionuclides that dissolve in water blow back to land in sea spray and marine aerosols, and even things like sea fog have now been shown to carry pollutants from the sea over the tide line and into inland scenarios. We've got marine bacteria in Texas have been shown to blow 100 miles inland from the coast, 100 miles inland, and cause a chest infection on people inland. And we know that organically bound tritium, where it transfers out of the water into organic material, it's probably particularly high in small forms of organic life like bacteria and viruses and fish eggs and things like that. So if any of that can blow ashore, it will give you a bigger dose than the water. But we know that dissolved radionuclides in sea spray can be elevated or enriched compared to the levels actually in the water body itself. So off the Sellafield coast near me, dissolved, they haven't bothered to look at tritium because they don't want to, but they've looked at cesium and they found that cesium in sea spray coming from the sea is twice as enriched as it is in the water body. So all of these things are mechanisms which would be perhaps reducing the amount of tritium in the seawater because it's going into animals as organically bound tritium, and because it's blowing ashore in sea spray or sea fog. Also, sorry about this, it's a bit of a tale of woe here, but also in 2023, some studies were carried out off the French reprocessor at Cap de la Hague, and they found there that over a 10-mile stretch of the plume of radioactive waste that had been discharged to sea, they were having tritium evaporating off the sea surface into the atmosphere above the sea, and then it was available to be blown wherever the wind blew it. That was quite a significant percentage. Now, the problem with that work is that because You can only do that work in mild sea conditions because you can't take a boat out there in a force 10 storm and start measuring stuff because it's just really too difficult. So all we have is the effect in very calm sea states with no waves breaking and no wind and so on and so on. So the theory is, from my point of view, that it's probably quite a significant amount of tritium evaporates off the sea surface when the conditions are extreme, and that too will blow ashore. And at the same time, that process is reducing the amount of tritium in the water. So if these guys who did the Japanese study that we've been talking about, where they were using Coco 4.9, if they conclude that the levels of tritium in the sea remain more or less stable and are not being increased by the Fukushima discharges, then I would argue that that's probably because that tritium is going into other compartments like marine animals and the sea to land and sea to air transfer. And if you think, say, of a coast that, like, 1,000 mile stretch of the west coast of the States, you've got an enormous amount there of wave breaking and sea spray coming ashore carrying tritium with it. And nobody's bothered to examine these mechanisms or phenomenon to see how important they are. We, as small anti-nuclear groups, we can't raise the money to do that kind of work. We can only review the documents and think about, yes, they're not doing a lot of hard work on this job. Why aren't they doing the hard work? Maybe they don't want to discover what looks as if it might be out there to discover.
We also have the problem here, certainly in Southern California, of what's called the morning marine layer, where we start out with a fog that reaches about 10, 15, 20 miles inland and then dissipates when the sun comes up and gets warmer and it's gone. But that also has the potential to carry any radioactivity that is in the water to be evaporated up into this morning marine layer and then deposited on the land when it dissipates. And that makes me think that we need to have some of those celebrities and rich people who live on the coastline come up with a little bit of chump change to find out exactly what they are being exposed to.
I fully agree with that. I'm not aware of any studies done on the US coast, but there have been studies done on the coast of Namibia in southwest Africa on the sea fog because it's a big phenomenon there over the Namib Desert. The fog comes in and it's the only water on that desert there. So there are lots of little animals and plants that are specially adapted to catch the fog. But the work they've done there wasn't looking at radioactivity, but it was looking at other pollutants. And it's actually capable of carrying actual particles, not just dissolved radioactivity, but solid particles of stuff which come off the sea surface when the morning sun rises on it and starts the evaporative process. And this stuff can blow several miles inland. So, yes, you're quite right. That probably is happening to some degree or another off the Californian coast and penetrating inland. Now, if I had the money, I would hire tritium air detectors which suck in air. And you can, I mean, the ones we have in the UK, I have looked at them longingly, but they cost about £1,000 a month to hire and deploy over here. But what they do is they suck in the air and they monitor it for its tritium content. And you can attach them to devices which calibrate and tell you which way the wind's coming and the time of any given peak in the results. So the technology is out there, but the nuclear industry don't want to use it. And we can only assume and make assumptions about why they don't want to use it. And as I say, my assumption is that they don't want to find out what they might find out.
Given the amount of profit that the nuclear industry makes, it would be no big deal for them to spend $1,000 a month on a tritium monitor. But clearly, the will is not there and the vision is not there. And basically, it's fingers in the ears and la, 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 we don't want to know.
Well, that's about it, isn't it? Which is what happened during the Fukushima run-up to these Fukushima discharges, where loads of people from your area, from the Pacific Islands, from China and the Philippines submitted data saying, please, for God's sake, don't do this because, and then giving peer-reviewed scientific information to TEPCO and the IAEA, who just chose to ignore it. And that final report that the IAEA wrote, giving TEPCO permission to do what they have done, the discharges, ignored all of that input and protect, you know, as if they had never had it and it had never been sent. So that tells us a tale, doesn't it?
How do you see this study being used by Japan, by TEPCO?
Well, they will use it to say, oh, look, this study by the Japanese universities, and it would be interesting to know, as a sideline, who sponsored it and where the money came from. But TEPCO and the Japanese ministries and the IAEA will say, well, look, here's your evidence, nothing to worry about. The vast amounts of radioactivity, the vast amounts of tritium that we are putting into the Pacific Ocean make no difference at all to the amount of tritium in the Pacific Ocean. That's just such a non sequitur. I mean, how do you square that? You're putting millions and billions of becquerels into the sea, and then you've got a paper saying, no, it doesn't increase the concentrations at all. And this is stuff that takes 12.3 years to reach its half-life. So it's not as if it was half-lifing and disappearing in a couple of days. Say 10 times 12.3 years before it's all completely and utterly vanished out of the Pacific. So this study is not to be relied upon, but it's great for the nuclear industry because they can say, no problems, this study proves it.
So the short version is, do you consider this study and the resulting media stories based upon it to be at minimum misleading?
Oh, definitely misleading. The whole study doesn't really seem to have the scientific feet to stand on because it doesn't use any data about tritium. It doesn't seem to comment on actually the fate and behavior of tritium in the environment. All it's doing is modeling the way the tides and the currents in the Pacific behave. But we've seen that other scientists have commented that it's a flawed model anyway, and it's not really sufficient to do the job. So the whole thing is really just a cover up and paying a bunch of scientists to come up with some sort of evidence, which I think, on the basis of what I've seen so far, is entirely spurious.
Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, what did you think of the play?
Yes, very good.
Tim Dear Jones, it is always exhilarating, challenging, but fulfilling and worthwhile to have you here as my guest on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Well, bless you. Thank you very much. It's lovely to talk with you. If you get kickback from the nuclear industry on this, let me see it and I'll see what I can do. But I bet you chances are that they'll just ignore it. Because when I send them tricky stuff, they never bother to reply. They just ignore it, which is the way they deal with us in the anti-nuclear campaigns.
Well, if there's any way I can get them to not ignore me, maybe get South Park to do an episode on it, put it on Colbert, something here in the States. They're the only truth tellers. If there's anything.
I bet they've got people watching you,
Oh, I'm
but
sure
they
I've got.
don't want to engage with it.
They're lurkers. It's like I have in the play. I'm still too small. I'm not big enough to matter. And there's another aspect too, I'll do, but let me just get off this. Tim, you make it so that I can't wait to talk to you the next time.
Well, thank you very much. Same to you. Good luck with all your work and good luck as the play unfolds as well.
Marine biologist, marine radioactivity researcher, and consultant, Tim Dear Jones. For those of you not familiar with the term half-life, it refers to the period of time it takes for a radioactive substance to become half as radioactive as it is to begin with. To find out how long it remains radioactive and thus a danger to health, multiply the half-life by 10. Tritium has a half-life of just over 12 and a half years, meaning it remains a radioactive threat for 125 years. Try telling that to Japan and TEPCO. We'll have this week's other featured interview in just a moment. But first, next week marks the 80th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. One would hope we'd have learned our nuclear lesson since those horrific attacks, which killed between an estimated 170,000 and 246,000 people. Human beings killed with just two bombs. But nope. Here we are in the middle of a new arms race, making more plutonium pits to trigger more nuclear bombs and saber-rattling our nuclear machismo around the world. And for what? To prove how stupid we are? To waste money as we expand a technology capable of destroying all life on Earth? And that's just the fast-by-blast means of nuclear destruction. The slow, steady release of radioactive elements from nuclear reactors and the entire nuclear fuel chain from uranium mining to taking care of the radioactive waste may be slower, but it's just as deadly to the future of people and the environment. In the midst of this week's coming acknowledgement of the violent start of the atomic age 8 decades ago, you need accurate information that contradicts the pro-nuclear propaganda that infests most mainstream media. That's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. Every week, we get into nuclear stories with facts, continuity, and context, providing a much deeper and nuanced telling than you would ever expect in mainstream media. But in order to keep doing this work, we need your help. That's why the time would be right now to support us with a donation. It's the only way we can keep going. So go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. Any amount helps, so don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com to donate, either one time or on an ongoing basis. Whatever you can do to help, know that I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's second featured interview. The nuclear industry doesn't know when to leave well enough alone. Not when it comes to shut down reactors and the chance to make money by attempting to bring them back to life. That's what we face in Michigan, where the Palisades nuclear reactor is on the verge of being resurrected despite known problems in its operations before it shut down, years of degradation from being up on the blocks, and having its proposed savior being Holtec, a nuclear demolition company that has never run, let alone restarted, a nuclear reactor. This restart scheme is being strongly opposed by a coalition of 66 organizations spearheaded by Beyond Nuclear and letters to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission from 145 experts saying, basically, don't do it, as well as a team of top-tier lawyers. As you will learn, even this is not likely to stop the Nuclear Regulatory Commission from rubber-stamping the scheme and giving it a big thumbs up. To learn what the problems are with the Palisades restart and the forces arrayed to push this through, I spoke with Arne Gunderson. He is a nuclear engineer, whistleblower, and green energy advocate who has been a consulting expert on many nuclear reactor issues, most specifically to me, the shutdown of the San Onofre nuclear power station in Southern California. I spoke with Arne about Palisades on July 26, 2025. Arne Gunderson, great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Hey, it's nice to be back, and I really appreciate all you do to keep people informed.
Let's start out with a brief history of the operations at the Palisades nuclear power plant in South Michigan and what problems they have faced there.
Well, this will make your head spin. I'm 76 years old, and Palisades design occurred when I was in high school. It went online when I was in college. I mean, we're talking about a really ancient nuclear reactor. The only reactor owned by the company, and as such, they never really had the corporate infrastructure to do it right. And in 1991, the steam generators failed, which is about 20 years. And at the time, that was pretty normal. The steam generators are the Achilles heel of a pressurized water reactor. Let me give you an idea of what they look like. They're maybe 50 feet high. They weigh 100 tons. They're like a giant tank, but they're vertical. They have 16,000 tubes inside them, actually 8,000 tubes going up, and then they curve and they go back down. So there's essentially 16,000 tubes, and they go in a U, so they're called a U-tube steam generator. So they got a new one in 91, and it was on its last legs in 2006 when the company sold it to Entergy, and Entergy ran it into the ground in 2022 and walked away. They wanted to dismantle the plant. They sold the plant to Holtec. Holtec even admitted that the steam generators were on their last leg in 2022. So that gets us up to the new owner, which is Holtec.
What background does Holtec have in operating nuclear reactors, let alone restarting one that has been shut down?
Nobody has ever restarted a nuclear plant that's been shut down. And Holtec has never, ever designed a nuclear plant, constructed a nuclear plant, or operated a nuclear plant. They're a demolition contractor. They bought the plant to demolish it. And then suddenly, I guess because they stayed at a Holiday Inn Express one night, they suddenly realized they could return the carcass of a plant. They actually used the term they could resurrect. That's their word. They were going to resurrect the Palisades reactor.
What's wrong with that idea?
Well, first off, Palisades never made money under Entergy. Entergy had a subsidy from the state. When the subsidy ran out in 2022, they walked away. So it was always highly subsidized. And Entergy knew it was going to walk away in 2022 and never did the necessary preventive maintenance to let it continue to operate. So they inherited a plant that was nobody had to put any investment into. But then they really screwed up big time too, because remember that when they bought it, their goal was to dismantle it. So they let the plant decay away for a couple of years. They kept the old water in the pipes. And normally when a plant shuts down, you put in chemicals to prevent that old water from becoming caustic and attacking the pipes. It's a thing called wet layup. If you let water sit in your toilet bowl without flushing for 2 years, it's going to not look the same as it did when it was fresh. And that's what they did. They let water sit in these steam generators for 2 years, and the chemical crap built up inside the steam generators. That's where we were in September of 2024, less than a year ago, when Holtec discovered what a mess it had gotten itself into.
Are there any other safety fixes, I'll put that in quotes, that have been attempted at Palisades that are less than desirable?
They are replacing and repairing hundreds of components that they let sit idle. They got close to $2 billion from the Department of Energy, and they got $300 million from the state of Michigan to turn this plant back on. But even then, they still have to have a subsidy because it's not cost competitive. So essentially, the government, Michigan and the feds, have given them in excess of $2 billion to resurrect this plant. And when they get there, they're still going to have to soak the ratepayers for more than renewable energy would cost. So there's dozens of components in the plant that were allowed to get rusty or get bend from the sheer weight of them and things like that. But the worst one are these steam generators.
Now Holtec has gone to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, for approval and go-aheads, the green light. What has happened there?
I've had my battles with the NRC over many, many years, and I've never been more frustrated by what's been going on. Basically, the groups that are opposing it, led by Beyond Nuclear and Don't Waste Michigan and NEIS and several others, have two really brilliant attorneys, Wally Taylor and Terry Lodge, who have filed petition after petition after petition. The NRC, there is no law here. You know, we're it's like Star Trek. We're going to where no man has gone before. There's no law regulating how to resurrect the carcass of a dead nuclear plant. And so every time Wally and Terry, the attorneys, file something, it's either too early or it's too late or it's out of scope. The biggest issue on my mind is the condition of these steam generators. We filed a report in June highlighting that I personally, as an expert, am confident that there's so much residual chemicals from the water that sat for 2 years. There's so much of those residual chemicals stuck in all the crevices, all the nooks and crannies inside this steam generator, that it's going to fail in the first 18 months. And the NRC has said, well, that's not the topic you're supposed to talk about in your filing. You're supposed to talk about sleeving the steam generators because of the damage that's already in there. And we keep saying, well, the issue's bigger than that because the damage that's already in there was caused by the fact that you let the water sit in these generators for 2 years, and there's more problems to come. So they filed on in June, and 30 days later, the NRC and Holtec filed opposing briefs. And then we had 7 days to respond to their hundreds of pages. And Holtec, for instance, said, I shouldn't be allowed to testify because I left the industry 30 years ago. So when you no longer work for the industry, you're no longer credible. So we had 7 days to respond. They got the response in on Friday at 11 p.m. and the NRC rejected the response at 6 a.m. Monday morning. You know, the deck is stacked. They are fast tracking the startup. Matter of fact, in the NRC's press release, you alluded to their they've allowed them to put fuel on site and fill the reactor. They have not allowed them to run it yet, but they've allowed them to get fuel on site. In their press release, they were bragging that they met the schedule. I mean, whose schedule is it? It's Holtec's schedule. So they're no longer the watchdog. They've actually had their teeth removed and their vocal cords snapped, so they can't even bite or bark. So that's where we're at right now, is that I have documented, that's a 50-page expert report documenting that it's pretty damn near inevitable that when the plant starts up, the combination of the heat of the hot water plus the fact that there's chemicals in all these crevices, it's going to fail. And the NRC is refusing to hear that and instead focusing on the ones that have already near fail. We're going to put sleeves in, and that is acceptable to prevent those cracks from getting worse. I've never felt more frustrated in my professional life.
A 1982 study commissioned by the NRC and carried out by Sandia Lab calculated that the impact of a nuclear reactor accident at Palisades could result in a Chernobyl or Fukushima style accident. What would be the impact of such an event on people and the environment?
The tube failure could be minor, or it could be a catastrophic meltdown. I'm sure something is going to happen, and I'm not really sure whether it'll be minor or catastrophic. But in the worst case, it would contaminate the Great Lakes and the 50, 60 million people that rely on the water in the Great Lakes. Unlike Fukushima was on the ocean, and 80% of the radiation went out into the Pacific, and they still detected radiation on the West Coast. The Great Lakes are much smaller than the Pacific Ocean, so it's much more serious. But also, Palisades is in the breadbasket of America. You know, it's yeah, it butts up against Lake Michigan, but it also is surrounded by land. There's no place for that radiation to go that's not harmful. The NRC actually suggested that the steam generator tube support plate and the tube sheet could fail. And if the tube sheet fails, it's game over. It's called a class nine accident. And the reason it would fail is because all these chemicals are down in these crevices, causing this 2 foot thick piece of metal to crack, at which point there's not enough water in the nuclear reactor to cool a core. So it could be that at best, from the public standpoint, A tube will leak, radiation will leak out, and there'll be enough water to control the nuclear chain reaction, and it'll blow away in a couple of days. That's the best circumstance. But when that happens, they're going to have to replace the steam generator anyway. So our position has been the steam generator is unsafe. Don't start it up, replace the steam generator. Now, Holtec has no assets. They rely on opium, other people's money, OPM. And they need to get that plant started this year because they run out of money. They can transfer it over and walk away with a boatload of cash for themselves. So their goal is to get it started. And it's kind of damn the torpedoes full speed ahead. They really want to kick the can down the road. And if it breaks in 2026, well, that's not their problem.
On July 24th, which, as we're speaking, is only 2 days ago, the NRC issued a final no significant hazards consideration determination, and they approved this going ahead. Apparently, there's still one step for the NRC commissioners to sign off on this. But what does this mean in terms of a timeline moving forward, and what is being done to oppose it?
The one step that they still have to clear is the steam generator issue. And that's going to be decided on August 25th. And it's interesting, the reason it's delayed, the NRC staff said, we'd like to sign off on the steam generator thing. Holtec, please send us the inspection information that you have on the condition of the steam generators. And Holtec refused.
Is that even legal?
Yeah, well, it is because when Holtec was in the decommissioning state, it changed its technical specifications to say it didn't need inspections. So it did inspections while it didn't need inspections and is now refusing to give those inspection results to the NRC to allow it to start up. So the NRC is delayed by a month their decision. But they're making a decision based on no information. So nothing's going to happen in the next month. The plant is, they're going to do some startup testing. They're going to move fuel on site, likely get fuel in the pool and perhaps in the reactor. They're not going to run until September at the earliest.
It makes me wonder whether the head of Holtec, Chris Singh, lives anywhere downwind and in proximity to the Palisades plant. That would be really interesting. So, in response to this rubber stamping of Holtec's request by the NRC, what is happening in the coalition that is fighting against this?
In administrative law, and what you've got to take this battle to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So you file the stuff we've been filing, they reject it. You then appeal to the full commission, they reject it. When you've run out of administrative remedies, you can go to court. And the attorneys are preparing to go to court to stop it. But you've got to work your way through all of the administrative remedies before you get to court. And even then, courts usually, on technical matters, courts defer to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. But on legal matters, the courts have been much more supportive of the public. So, the fact that the NRC's got no roadmap to do this, there's nothing in regulation that allows them to do that. Those legal arguments might be appealing to the court. But my argument about, well, the steam generator may melt down and cause the evacuation of the state of Michigan, that's probably something the courts would defer to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on. The battle continues. The attorneys will go to the full commission and get rejected, and then they'll go to court.
And what is your position as this continues to go forward?
Well, I've provided the expert reports on several items. I think I've probably written maybe 200 pages of expert reports on the plant, including the effect of climate change and things like that, all of which have been ignored by the commission. But eventually, if they get to court and if the judge decides they have a case, then my work will become, basically, I'll testify in a court of law. But we have to expect that the NRC staff and the NRC attorneys are going to reject it. Then we have to expect that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission itself will reject it as well. And at that point, the lawyers will go to federal court to try to stop it.
Is there anything we haven't covered that you'd like to add at this time?
You know, Leonard Cohen, the phenomenal songwriter from Canada, he has a song, and everybody knows the dice are loaded, everybody knows the deck is stacked. And those words just come back to me again and again and again on this case.
Arnie, we'll stay in touch and find out what further is happening with Palisades. For now, I want to thank you for joining us and being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks, Libby. Thanks for doing all that you do.
Nuclear engineer, whistleblower, and green energy advocate, Arnie Gunderson. Of course, we will continue to keep you abreast of the developments on the proposed Palisades restart.
Activists, shout out, shout out, shout out.
It is with deep sadness that we report on the passing of Daniel Hirsch. He was founder and president of the Committee to Bridge the Gap and a tireless opponent of the nuclear industry. His lectures to students at UCLA led to them uncovering the 20-year cover-up of the nuclear accident at the Santa Susana Field Lab, only 34 miles from downtown Los Angeles. Dan was a tireless, articulate, and accessible source of information on nuclear, an early supporter of Nuclear Hot Seat, and a wonderfully kind and humane individual who was a support to all those who reached out to him. We deeply mourn his loss. If you wish to know more about how he broke this cover-up story about the Santa Susana Field Lab accident and resulting radioactive contamination, I interviewed him in the very early days of this show for Nuclear Hot Seat number 47 in 2012. We'll have a link up to that episode on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 735. And we also mark the passing of musical satirist Tom Lehrer, who passed away this week at the age of 97. The biting edge of his songs included several dealing with nuclear issues, and because he so graciously put his entire catalog in public domain several years ago, we will be going out on one of his songs this week. We will all go together when we go. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 28, 2025. If you want to get Nuclear Hot Seat the easiest way possible, you can get it delivered via email every week as soon as it posts. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. The yellow box pops up right there. You can't miss it. Put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get one email, just one, which includes a link to that week's show and a short description of its content. This way, you need never miss a single episode. You can also sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Any amount helps out, be it one time or on an ongoing basis, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat reminding you, a nuclear accident anywhere is a nuclear accident everywhere. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat. Here's Tom Lehrer.
For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go.